Good morning. The chair calls the third meeting of the ALA Council to order. Excuse me. Before we begin today's meeting, I'd like to show a delightful short video that documents the DC public school students' impassioned reflections of what they love about their library. It is a direct result of the hard work of DC Public School Libraries Director Pat Brown.
Can you ask him to turn your monitors on?
Would you turn the monitors on? Thank you. Director Pat Brown to promote the Declaration of the Right to Libraries campaign. Ms. Brown's team has made a logo for the campaign, which will be reprinted on t-shirts, stickers, and buttons. Their adopted theme is DC Loves Libraries. If you all will run the video now, thank you.
All schools should have library programs because, well, it's just the way it is. People need books. And books can't read themselves.
We love libraries.
I love the library because it has its own diary series and the Twilight series.
I love the library because there's a wide variety of books that I like.
Well, I don't really have a favorite book. I mean, all the books are.
I love the library because they have books in Spanish that I can read.
I love the library because I can check out books because at my old school, you really couldn't check out books. There was no librarian.
I like to read, and when I was in first grade, I couldn't read that good. So books helped me a lot.
If the library was gone, no one would have education because they would not be able to read.
When I was in first grade, we didn't have the chance to check out books, which was awful because we only had a part-time librarian.
It helps you go up to higher reading levels, and when you go up to higher reading levels, you get smarter in reading, and reading is very important.
My favorite thing is to look for a book that I don't have at home.
I love books, so without a library, I wouldn't know what to do. If the library at my school was gone, a lot of kids, including me, wouldn't come here and do research or maybe check out books or learn something that they don't really know about. That's why I think all schools should have a library.
I like the library because I love the librarian. She's really nice.
I like the library because it's usually a quiet place where you can come to possibly work on homework or like come read. And there's also really good research tools here.
It's not a school without a library. That's like dumb. Like you're there to get your education and there to have books. And the books shouldn't only be about books or sex. It should be about other subjects like fiction, nonfiction.
Without books, I would be lost.
So I send a special thank you to Chris Corrigan from DC and also to Pat Brown. Thank you for sharing. I see that all counselors have already occupied the seats in the front of the room. We will follow the same rules at this meeting that we approved during ALA Council 1 meeting. As a courtesy to others, please remember to turn off your cell phone or turn it to silent prompting. If you need to make or take a call, if you will please leave the chambers and then come back immediately. Also, please watch the overhead screen for the motion description to use on your voting card, and you may only use that description. Your voting record is at your place. You should have a blue voting card. Right now, please write your name at the top and sign at the bottom. If you must leave before adjournment, please take your card to Lois and Gregory Wood. I'd like to just start with a little personal note. To me, the culture of council is part of the soul of librarians. It is civil discourse. It's democracy in action. That's very important to me to build that culture. I hope that you all trust me as chair of the meetings to treat everyone with respect and to give time for us to hear every viewpoint and really to operate the meeting that builds a culture of support and respect. I trust you as members of council to help me build that culture. So I hope that we can work together and make sure that everyone who is here feels very comfortable to contribute, to question, to push back, to offer alternative opinions, to stand up and speak for what you believe. So I just hope we approach today in that light. A quorum for a council meeting is 75 councilors. We have well over 75 councilors present, and therefore we have a quorum. Written reports should not be read, and when resolutions are presented, only the resolved clauses will be read. The agenda council document 8.3, revised 1/27/14, 7:30 p.m., and all other documents issued since the last council meeting are available at the council webpage and at the document pickup tables in this room. Again, I would suggest that those of you who are on the agenda come up quickly to report and sit to my right. We already have a good example of that before your presentation so we can save time. We've received no other new items for business, but we might have new items to add. Microphone 3.
Point of information, Courtney Fuson, Tennessee Chapter Counselor. The updated agenda does not appear to be available on the council website.
All right. You have it accomplished. It will be there shortly. Thank you. Are there any items to be added to the agenda? If there are no items to be added, hearing no, do I have approval of council to adopt the agenda as presented? Consent, thank you. The agenda is adopted. Council Policy 5.3 provides that memorials, tributes, and testimonials will be presented at the beginning of the last session of the ALA Council at the annual conference. I believe that should be midwinter conference. Aren't we in midwinter? I will now read the names of persons recognized by memorial resolutions. Let us stand, please. As I read the names of those remembered today, they are Augusta Gussie Clark, Major Owens, Nasser Sharifi, and Bowden Stefan Weinar. Thank you. Please be seated. We've received one tribute resolution to announce today. Giovanni's Room Bookstore and owner Ed Hermance. But we also have a tribute as the last item in the COL report for Senator John D. J. Rockefeller IV. And with your permission, I would like to be sure that that item is moved into the tributes and becomes a part of the tribute record with your consent. All right. Thank you. Copies of the memorials and tributes are available on the council webpage and at the council documents pickup table. I now call your your attention to ALA Council Document 11.2 and ask Councillor John Sandstrom to report. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is John Sandstrom, and I had the pleasure of being chair of the tellers for this conference. I'd like to begin by thanking my fellow tellers, Ken Slade, Denise Zielinski, and Brenda Pruitt-Anisette. We met last night at 7:30. There were 138 ballots requested, 138 ballots cast. The following three candidates were elected to three-year terms and will be seated on the executive board at its fall meeting on October 24th through 26th, 2014 in Chicago. These are Peter D. Hepburn, Gina A. Persicini, and Gail A. Schlachter. The following candidate will be seated immediately on the executive board at the 2014 midwinter meeting to complete the unexpired five-month term, January 28th through July 1st, 2014, of Sylvia K. Norton, recently appointed executive director of the ALA, American Association of School Librarians, AASL, and that is Mike L. Martin.
Thank you, John. Will the new members, will the newly elected executive board members please stand so that we can... Microphone four.
Mike Marlin. M-A-R-L-I-N, right?
Yes. Yes.
He said Martin.
Well, oh, then...
Please forgive me. It is Marlin, and it is written correctly.
Will the newly elected members of the executive board please stand so that we can recognize you? On behalf of all of us, I would like to say thank you for running for, thank you, John, for running and for volunteering to commit yourselves to some intensive but very rewarding work. And I would also like to commend everyone who ran. Good for you. And if you weren't elected, all of us have run more than once for things, so run again. I now direct your attention to ALA CD number 19 through CD number 19.2 and call upon Douglas Archer, Chair of the Intellectual Freedom Committee, to report. Doug?
Thank you. Thank you. You have the written report. I will not read it as instructed. I just want to highlight a couple of items that we've been working on this year. One is we are revising the Intellectual Freedom Manual. We're working on a ninth edition, and between now and Las Vegas, you should receive copies of documents that are either new or being suggested for revision for your comments, suggestions, corrections, etc. We've been working on a revision of the Privacy Toolkit since 2005, and that should be available on the web by March 1st. And we have undergone a slight change in structure. We're adding three members from the Committee on Legislation to our privacy group so that we can work more closely together on these vital issues that we both seem to be so concerned with. And you can read the Lemony Snicket's Award yourself. We continue to support Banned Books Week and Privacy Week, and I have a resolution for you. This is a joint resolution coming from both committees, resolution on expanding federal whistleblower protection. And there are three resolves.
Document number 19.2.
Resolve that the American Library Association, on behalf of its members, urges Congress to amend the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 2012 to extend existing legal protections for whistleblowers to employees of all national security and intelligence agencies and to non-federal employees working for civilian contractors. 2, urges Congress to establish a secure procedure by which all federal employees and all non-federal employees working for civilian contractors may safely share evidence they have discovered of fraud, waste, or abuse with the appropriate oversight committees of Congress and directly with the press and the American people, and with the protection of legally enforceable rights against retaliation or prosecution. And three, commends the courage and perseverance of federal employees and non-federal employees working for civilian contractors who risk their livelihoods, their reputations, and their liberty to expose evidence of government fraud, waste, or abuse.
Are there any questions or comments for Mr. Archer? Microphone four.
Al Kagan, Sir Counselor. I want to commend the two committees for this resolution. I think we're making progress in understanding the depth of the threat of the national security state that we're currently living in, and I hope we continue to work on this in the future.
Microphone four.
Carrie Hartman, Wyoming Chapter Counselor. I would just like to discuss the phrase non-federal employees working for civilian contractors. I believe that phrase means that civilian contractors themselves would not be protected under this, and I would hope the committee would consider revising that statement.
You can say the intent was to cover both the employees and the contractors, but we understood the ambiguity there. Almost all whistleblowers per se are individuals. So we weren't thinking in terms of companies, but we'll certainly consider it.
Microphone four.
Jim Kuhn, Counselor at Large. I want to thank the Intellectual Freedom Committee and the Committee on Legislation for this very strong resolution, and I'm pleased with the language. I particularly am pleased to see the phrase, the protection of legally enforceable rights against retaliation or prosecution in resolve number two, and I'm very pleased to see this coming forward to this body. Thank you.
Microphone three.
Bernie Margolis, Counselor at Large. When I woke up this morning, I was planning on voting for this, and I will vote for it.
Is there any further discussion? If not, we will proceed to the vote. Will all those in favor of Council Document 19.2, Resolution on Expanding Federal Whistleblower Protections, please signify by raising your hand. All those opposed, the motion passes. Please mark your ballot, CD number 19.2. The next item on the agenda, the other resolution offered by the Intellectual Freedom Committee, is a joint resolution with the Committee on Legislation. So I've asked Vivian Nguyen to join us and to present that resolution. Vivian?
Good morning, everyone. As stated, IFC and COL have worked on two resolutions. So we are now talking about 20.1, which is also 19.1 in the IFC report, Resolution on Curbing Government Surveillance and Restoring Civil Liberties. The first resolve calls upon Congress to pass legislation supporting the reforms embodied in H.R. 3361 or S-1599 as introduced, and upon the President to sign such legislation, excuse me, and commends Senator Patrick Leahy and Congressman James Sensenbrenner for sponsoring the USA Freedom Act. The 143 legislators in the Senate and the House who have co-sponsored it, and the 85 organizations that have endorsed it as of January 27, 2014. Are there any questions?
Wait a minute. That wasn't exact. Okay. We need it on the screen then, the resolved clauses. I thought you were delivering your report and just telling us what you were going to present. I'm sorry, I didn't set you up right. So she did actually read the resolve clauses of 20.1, and can we have those up on the screen, please?
20.1? I'm sorry if I jumped the gun.
No, it was the way I set you up. All right, so Vivian, would you do me a favor and read them again officially as resolve clauses of 20.1?
Okay, so the resolution is 20.1, resolution on curbing government surveillance and restoring civil liberties. The first resolve calls upon Congress to pass legislation supporting the reforms embodied in H.R. 3361 or S-1599 as introduced, and upon the President to sign such legislation, and commends Senator Patrick Leahy and Congressman James Sensenbrenner for sponsoring the USA Freedom Act, the 143 legislators in the Senate and House who have co-sponsored it, and the 85 organizations that have endorsed it as of January 27, 2014.
Is there any discussion of the motion? Microphone 3.
Bernie Margolis, Counselor at Large. I support this, but since process is our most important product here, I want to make a suggestion, and that is that we divide the question, at least for our official record, because it seems to me we're doing two very different things. We're urging Congress to pass legislation and the President to sign it, and then we are complimenting and commending a couple particular legislators and the larger body of legislators. It seems to me those are two very important but very separate activities, and I think it'd be helpful if the communication of those were in fact separate on our record and separate in how our executive director relays those to the appropriate parties. So I hope that would be something friendly that I wouldn't have to make a motion to do, and that the chair could entertain. Thank you.
Is there a consent of the council to divide this? Any objections? Did I hear an objection? All right, I'm informed by our parliamentarian that the division of a resolution can be accomplished by the request of one person, and we do not need consent, so it will be divided. All right, so the first we will vote on, is there any other discussion? Microphone 3.
David Hurley, Counselor at Large. Just out of curiosity, can resolutions be merged by one person?
Sturgis covers divide. It does not cover merge. Who knew? All right, are we ready for the vote on the first piece? Thank you. Oh my goodness, so efficient. I will read it. Resolve that the American Library Association calls upon Congress to pass legislation supporting the reforms embodied in H.R. 3361 and Senate 1599 as introduced, and upon the President to sign such legislation. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed? Thank you. The motion passes. Mark your ballot CD number 19.1 and CD 20.1, part 1. Now we will proceed to the second piece of this, the second resolved clause. Resolved that the American Library Association commends Senator Patrick Leahy and Congressman James Sensenbrenner for sponsoring the USA Freedom Act. The 143 legislators in the Senate and the House who have co-sponsored it, and the 85 organizations that have endorsed it as of January 27, 2014. All those in favor of this motion, please raise your hand. Opposed? The motion passes. Mark your ballot, CD number 19.1 and CD number 20.1, part 2. Now I'd like to ask Vivian Nguyen to deliver her report from the Committee on Legislation.
Thank you, Barbara. The Committee on Legislation brings another action item to you in their report. This is document 20.3. Resolution on maintaining government websites during a government shutdown. This has many resolves, so bear with me. Resolved that the American Library Association urges the President to direct the Office of Management and Budget and Department of Justice to develop guidance to federal agencies stating that in the event of government shutdown or other public or other emergency, continued access by the public to essential information on agency websites is an accepted activity that would warrant the retention of personnel or the obligation of funds to assure access. Two, urges the Office of Management and Budget, in the absence of such a guideline, to direct each agency to communicate the status during a shutdown of its website to the government printing office or another appropriate agency, which would widely communicate and update information about which agencies are maintaining their websites, which are updating them, and which are closing them. Three, urges OMB to require each agency to determine what information is essential and should be available if a government shutdown or emergency should occur. For such an occurrence, develop a contingency plan for continued public access to information. Four, urges OMB to direct agencies to work with GPO in hosting their online publications and data in the federal digital system or other publicly accessible means. Urges GPO to expand its automated harvesting of federal agencies' websites and to redirect persistent uniform resource locators to GPO harvested copies rather than agency websites. And six, urges that GPO or other appropriate agency be directed to maintain a clearinghouse of web pages that provide alternate ways of accessing government information. We are all aware that during the government shutdown, a lot of government information was not made available. So this resolution is addressing that, as well as the fact that what websites were available or were not available was also very difficult to locate.
Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing no Microphone three.
Daniel Cornwall, Alaska Chapter Counselor. And I wanted to thank the Committee on Legislation, and I know there were several bodies involved, and I'd like to thank them all. I am in support of virtually everything in this resolution, except I do have a motion to amend, and do I speak it first or deliver it first?
It would be helpful if you delivered it first, and I'll hold your place. To Lois Ann, so they can get it typed. Brian, were you wanting to speak? Microphone three.
Brian Schottlander, Lex Division Counselor. The Lex Board of Directors is generally in support of this resolution. However, we wondered whether we could hear a little bit more about why the first resolved statement is confined to directing OMB and DOJ because it's our understanding that there are certain federal agencies, both legislative and executive, that do not fall under the jurisdiction of those two bodies.
Vivian, would you like to respond?
I understand the concern. I think it was the thought of our GIS subcommittee, as well as GoDort, which worked and saw this and endorsed the content, that this was the most efficient way for it to be directed.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Microphone four.
Are you there? Here we are. Elena Rosenfeld, Colorado Chapter Counselor. My only concern is resolve number two. While it implies that this goes to the public, it is not stated clearly. And implied wording doesn't always translate when implementation comes through. So just a note of concern, but I appreciate all this work.
Microphone four.
Ann Crudson, Counselor at Large. I just wanted to thank the COL for this resolution, and in particular as a diversity counselor, thank you very much for changing the first whereas clause so that it's U.S. persons and not U.S. citizens. It is far more inclusive. Thank you.
Can I suggest a word change myself?
If it's the document belongs to council at this point, it's been presented. But if it's a simple word change that's not substantive in content, we already decided that Keith Fields will do that. If it's not a substantive content change, then council has already given permission for that to happen after it passes. Is it substantive content?
I was wanting to react to the person at microphone four, and I understand the concern. This actually came up at the forum, that it says which would widely communicate, and I am suggesting that if we insert to the public, the issue goes away.
Yeah, that's, we can do that after the fact. No problem. Microphone six.
Daniel Cornwall, Lasker Chapter Counselor. Thank you for your indulgence. So now that my motion has been properly filed and seconded, what I would like to ask council to do is to strike the first paragraph entirely, and from the second paragraph do strike in the absence of such a guideline. And the reason why I'm asking for this is I've been a library supervisor for like 15 years, and one of the things I've really tried to live by is to never ask anybody to do something that I'm not willing to do myself. And I feel that our asking, potentially in the event of a shutdown, federal employees to work without pay, if that's not something that we as a group are comfortable doing ourselves, is not something we should be asking others. Thank you.
Microphone three.
Coral Sheldon Hess, Counselor at Large.
I'm sorry, I needed to clarify. We need to have conversation around the proposed amendment.
I'm speaking in favor of the amendment.
All right, and then go ahead.
I'm a web services librarian. I build websites for a living. And I think there might be a misconception that you can just flip go and the website's on and there's no requirement to maintain it, to reset the servers now and then. We are asking people to work for free. I'm uncomfortable with that. I think that turning off websites when you're not being paid is one of the very few forms of protest that government employees are allowed to have. and I respect their right to do that. As public employees ourselves, many of us, not all, it shows poor solidarity to ask them to do this. Thank you.
Thank you. You want to speak?
I would just like to speak to those concerns, and I certainly absolutely agree with you that no one should ever be asked or expected to work without pay. This was something that we discussed at length, and we felt that we had covered it. If you go back to the first resolve, you will see the final line that says that the agency would have the obligation to assure that the funds were available. So we were not doing that in the sense that we were very clear about the fact that the agency needed to establish within their agency what would be essential information for the public, and that they would have a plan in place so that the essential employees, in order to make that access available, were there and paid. So there was no expectation in any of this language that people would be asked to work without pay.
Microphone four.
Vicki Krohn, counselor from the FAFLIRT, Federal Armed Forces Librarians Roundtable. I want to speak in favor of the amendment striking the first section for a couple of reasons. Primarily, we're doing the not in my backyard thing. The websites are not the only essential part of federal libraries. It's also not just federal employees that would be required to maintain the sites. Many of them are contracted out, which brings in the whole kettle of fish of which contracts do we fund and which ones don't we fund. And it's undermining the whole point of the shutdown. We shouldn't be figuring out workarounds for a shutdown. We should be preventing a shutdown. We are essential across the board. Thank you.
Microphone three.
Stephanie Bronstein, Louisiana Chapter Counselor. I think since I've walked up here, there have been more comments made that might make my comment irrelevant. But I do want to point out that while we don't want to support the requirement for people to work when not being paid, there's a larger picture here where the information that is should be available to the citizens that pay for this information will not have access to it. And if we can provide for some way of making sure that if there is government shutdown in the future, hopefully not, that there will be ways to have the most important information that's now being, excuse me, electronically delivered to continue to be so.
Microphone six. Oh, never mind. Microphone three.
Karen Schneider, Counselor at Large. As a library administrator and former IT director for libraries, I speak in favor of the amendment eliminating that first section because when an unattended website is also a security issue, and the long-term preservation and access to that data will be much more important than being able to access it in one of the many inevitable government shutdowns we apparently will be facing in the next few years.
Is there any? Microphone three.
David Hurley, Counselor at Large. And I just kind of changed my mind on this, and I'm speaking against this amendment. I agree with sort of what everyone is saying. On the other hand, as the ALA, I think we have to say, I think as ALA, we have to say this information is really important and our public needs access to it. And it's up to the federal government to figure out how to make that work. Thank you.
Microphone three.
It's my turn now. Yay. Lauren Comito, Counselor at Large. Is it possible to amend an amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Then I might have to go write it down. But I think it might be good to say that it's an exempted activity that would warrant the obligation of funds to take out the retention of personnel and the obligation of funding, because providing that funding allows them to pay the personnel. Can they pay the personnel?
What would help us is if you write it and take it to Lois Ann so that we can see what you're thinking of.
I wasn't sure I was allowed to do it.
And then when you present it, you'll have an opportunity to speak to it. Microphone 4.
Chris Corrigan, DCLA chapter counselor. I believe in the last government shutdown, nobody was paid because the continuing resolution to fund the government was not approved. So if that happens again, people won't be paid because there would be no money.
Microphone 3.
Nick Buron, counselor at large. I'll help stall for Lauren while this is going through. Well, then I'll use my time. I'm here. I'm not really sure which way to go on this. As someone who
Nick,
doesn't...
Nick, would you identify?
Oh, I thought I did. Nick Buron, counselor at large. I'm not sure, because I'm relying on other people. I'm listening to other people who are a lot closer to this issue, and I'm trying to figure out which way to go on this. It's an amendment towards something that a big ALA committee has put together, smart people like us. And the thing that I'm coming down on is that I feel that we would have more... What's going to have the impact? And I feel that we would have more impact urging OMB to do something than to go through the President of the United States to get to OMB, to get to the Department of Justice, because the Department of Justice loves the American Library Association. So in the end, I speak towards the amendment, and I will be voting for the amendment. Thank you.
Microphone 6.
Pat Wand, counselor at large. You know, this is an issue about which we need more expert information. And we have a Washington office staff that has been working in these issues for the months during and since the shutdown. So can we call on them to address this issue about who's paid? There are exempt paid staff in the federal government that were paid during the shutdown to provide essential information for us. So perhaps our Washington staff can be a resource.
With the consent of council, we can invite someone to address the body with expertise or information. Do I have consent to ask? All right, Lynn, would you approach the microphone? Microphone 5. I'm sorry. Microphone 5.
Lynn Bradley, director of the ALA Office of Government Relations in the Washington office. This was put together by Godard and the Government Information Subcommittee. And point one, I would suggest, really gives the authority and pushes from the top of that authority on down to the more specific actions to assure that government information and as many websites as possible are available to the American public. First of all, I believe federal workers were paid. Those who were laid off were paid. And secondly, it is this word essential, and having, because there are employees that are designated essential, each agency is charged with designating what essential services and essential personnel would be there. And I believe number one suggests or indicates that each agency must say that government information and these websites are essential, and each agency would determine, and it might be different from agency to agency, both what should be kept online and kept up, as well as the employees to support that effort.
Barbara? Yes, Vivian?
I would just like to accentuate the fact that this document, it was developed with many hours of work. We had, I would say, at least 4 or 5 versions that passed through not only our GIS subcommittee, but the entire COL committee, as well as Godard. I'm always a little nervous when we start moving words around when a document has been so carefully prepared, because I'm afraid that perhaps we change the meaning without really realizing that we're doing that. So I'm cautious. That's all I'm saying.
Microphone three.
Jennifer Bocher, RUSA counselor. I'm wondering if we do accept the amendment, the part of the things that we'll be taking out is including the Department of Justice. If that is not a part of the resolution, what would that mean for this, what we're trying to get to?
She's talking about substantive. Microphone six.
Liz Bischoff, ASCLA counselor. I'm speaking against the amendment. I think that the way it's been revised, it takes out key aspects of the intent of the resolution. The first one it takes out is that this is an essential activity of government. And I think that we want the provisioning of information services to be recognized as an essential activity. It also takes out the obligation to fund that essential activity. All that the amendment or the replacement says is that it directs the communication of the status, directs each agency to communicate the status of the websites. And that's halfway there. But the status could be that it's shut down. So while I appreciate the intent of the amendment or the revision of the resolution, I think it really weakens the intent of these of this resolution. So I urge us to vote the amendment down and go with the original proposed resolution. Thank you.
Thank you. Microphone three.
Bill Suddeth, Godort counselor. As I look at this, it bothers me, I'm speaking against the amendment, in that you're also removing two important aspects, which is the president to be able to act in an emergency situation. We know the shutdown was something that was kind of self-inflicted, but this first part one also extends that for emergency situations that we might not be able to think of, and takes away that the executive's ability to act for our benefit. So I would urge voting against the motion.
Microphone four.
Vicki Crone, Federal and Armed Forces Librarians Roundtable. I want to support the concern that you mix an emergency with a ploy, basically. The government shutdown has gotten to be the hammer we beat each other over the head with. I did want to clarify that essential employees are not necessarily paid, and retroactive pay is not to be assumed. That was a separate bill that was passed because of the uproar after the fact. As a federal employee, when we were told we were furloughed, we had no idea if we were going to get paid. You are also not allowed to call in sick. You can lose your job if you call in sick and you're designated essential. You can't say, I'm sick, I've got the flu, but my coworker who is non-essential could come in and do that for me. So I think before ALA makes a statement about things that they may not be as fully informed about, there are lots of implications here, and I'd like to recommend that perhaps we get some more expertise in how that funding works before we, obviously, we want the websites and the information available. But it's not as simple as, well, just throw some money at it, because if they could do that, they would have done it and not shut down in the first place. Thank you.
Microphone four.
Jane Glasby, counselor at large. I must admit, when I first saw this, I was a little worried about it. Not the amendment, but the original resolution, because I thought of the point that somebody else has made, that this is the only form of protest that the employees can take. And then other people have talked about things that I want to speak in support of what Councillor Crone has just talked about. I feel that as it stands, I would vote for the amendment, but I would like to move to postpone this till annual, the discussion of this resolution.
Do you have a second, Jane? Yes, all right. It has been moved and seconded to postpone this. We will have to postpone the whole document, not just the amendment.
Because, right, yes, that's okay. That was my intention.
Okay. To annual conference is
yes.
What you asked for. Annual conference of 2014. Is there any discussion on the motion to postpone? Microphone 3.
Bernie Margolis, Councillor at Large. I oppose the motion to postpone as presented. If it doesn't include some guidance in terms of what the postponement time will be used for, then we're going to be back here again talking about the same issues one more time. So if the mover of the motion to postpone would give some guidance in terms of what she's expecting to happen, whether COL relooks at it, whether it is reviewed by other parts of ALA, you know, let's be a little bit more focused in our work so that our outcomes are outcomes that we're happy with.
James.
I was going to share, though, that when I woke up this morning and I read the Alaska Councillor's proposal, this amendment, I was planning to vote no, and if we get a chance today, I will vote no.
Jane, would you like to respond to...
I would like the Committee on Legislation to look at it again and re-present the resolution to us in consultation with the relevant bodies, but I'm willing to take suggestions from the floor as to what would be suitable people to be looking at it.
All right. It's been suggested, Ellie suggested that what you could move is to refer it back to the Committee on Legislation. I mean...
Right, I will do that then.
All right. Is there... Microphone 3, are you speaking to the motion to refer?
Daniel Cornwall, Alaska Chapter Counselor. I am speaking against the motion to refer. It was never, ever my intention to make the perfect the enemy of the good. And I would personally rather withdraw my amendment than see it get referred back to the Committee on Legislation. I have trust in them, but I'd like to deal with this issue today. And if that means withdrawing, I'm willing to do that.
It belongs to us now, so you can't withdraw it.
Very well. Thank you.
But we can end up there by our voting. Microphone 3.
Nick Buron, Councillor at Large. We have the time. Let's push this through.
Is there any further discussion on the motion to refer and postpone to annual conference? Microphone 2.
John Sandstrom, Councillor at Large. I would like to speak in favor of the motion to refer because there have been some questions brought up about who is and who is not paid, who is essential, who is not essential personnel, and I would like to hear those issues addressed in an authoritative fashion rather than the sort of unclear indications that we've been getting so far. Thank you.
Any other discussion on the motion to refer? If not, I ask you to vote, please. All those in favor of referring CD 20.3 back to COL until annual conference 2014, please raise your hand. All those opposed? I believe we need a count. Sorry, it's too close to call. All those in favor, will you please stand? And in favor of the motion to refer CD 20.3 back to COL until annual conference 2014. Thank you. Please be seated. All those opposed to referring? Thank you. Please be seated. Point of personal privilege, microphone 3.
Thank you. I think I can do that. Michael Goldwick taught me that. Very briefly, I would say this is a vote that had no good outcome. And the reason we're in that position is because we're still running council like it was 1895, and we came here in covered wagons, and we're passing around parchment by gaslight to pass resolutions. It's ridiculous that we vote on these things twice a year, like we didn't have some other media to do this. Just want to say that. Thanks.
All right. Result of the vote was 62 in favor of referring and 86 opposed to referring. The motion to refer fails. And now we are back to discussing the amendment to CD 20.3, refer back to COL until annual conference. We are now back to discussing the amendment to 20.3. And I'll just remind you, the amendment strikes the first resolved clause and strikes a few words in the second resolved clause. Okay. Microphone 4.
Chris Corrigan, DCLA chapter counselor. So essential employees were expected to report to work without pay. Certain personnel, Capitol police officers, it took an act of Congress to pay them during the government shutdown after a shooting on Capitol grounds. Thank you.
Seeing no one else at the microphone, we will bring this to a vote. What we are voting on is the amendment to 3, to strike the first resolved clause and the few words in the absence of such a guideline in the second resolved clause. All those in favor, please raise your hand. All those opposed? The motion fails. The amendment fails. So we are now back to the main motion. Mark your ballot. CD 20.3 amend. So we are now back to the main motion, 20.3. Is there any further discussion on the main motion? Microphone 5.
So, Zora Sampson, counselor at large. I guess I'm going to try to be brave enough to express massive ignorance. I'm a little confused at what we're asking for here. Are we asking for just a way back machine that shows just government information with no work and working forms, phone numbers that nobody will answer the phone? I'm just a little confused here as what it is we're asking for. And I think that a lot of people just thought, well, why can't we just keep the information up there? Well, we already have a Wayback Machine that does that, I think. So I'm confused. I'm sorry.
Vivian?
While this is a complex issue and there are lots of words and terminology here, let me just kind of outline the intent of our GIS subcommittee and COL. The concern, of course, was that government information was not available when the shutdown came. The complexity is that when we are saying within the various agencies certain information is so essential that there has to be some kind of a plan for that never to happen again, so that we have those resources for the public. There is no way to kind of cite that, so what we are saying is that there needs to be a mandate to the agencies that they determine before there is a problem what pieces of information or resources that would be, and to prepare to be able to fund the personnel that have to keep those sites or those resources available. and that if the agency doesn't create such a guideline, then they will be mandated to create such a guideline. And the other piece that was very much a part of the discussion is the fact that with all of that confusion, nobody could tell what was up, what wasn't up, what was being updated, and that there needs to be some kind of a central place so that everyone can figure out these resources from this agency will stay up, these resources from this agency will stay up, and we're the central point that can help the public to know which ones are available. That's the intent that I took away from all of the work that was done. I hope that is some help.
Microphone two.
John Sandstrom, Counselor at Large. I am actually surprising myself by speaking against this resolution. I believe that if the Congress is going to be so idiotic as to let the government shut down, they should shut down all the websites so the people of the United States will see exactly what our Congress is doing and vote them out. Thank you.
Microphone two.
Andrew Pace, Counselor at Large. I think I just want to stand up to remind us that the resolution urges, and that there are people that have worked very hard on this resolution who are very intimate with a lot of the general philosophical issues. And if our urging of the President and the OMB and the DOJ works, there are many other people who are intimate with the details of how to implement such a plan to make the resolution fulfilled. And so I think we should not get involved in the implementation details of something that we are simply urging people to do.
Microphone three.
I have an amendment. Lauren Cavito, Counselor at Large. I would like to insert the word paid in the first resolved clause. So do I have to read the entire thing, or can I read the sentence where I insert it?
We see it on the screen now.
Oh, great. Yes. So the continued access by the public to essential information on agency websites is an accepted activity that would warrant the retention of paid personnel or the obligation of funds to ensure access.
Would you like to speak to the motion?
Yes. I work in a socioeconomically disadvantaged neighborhood, and a lot of these websites had information that my patrons needed very badly. So I would very much like to see this resolution go forward so that those people who can't always speak up for themselves because they don't have time, they're working two jobs, whatever it is, can have us speak up for them. I also want to see employees doing work being paid for their work. And since we're not Congress and we can't make them do this, so we are urging them to do this, I'd like to urge them to pay this and reinforce the fact that we want these employees to be paid for providing these essential services to our patrons.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion on the proposed amendment of adding the word paid to the first resolved clause? Seeing no one at the microphone, I call the vote. All those in favor of the amendment to add paid to the first resolved clause of 20.3, please raise your hand. All those opposed, please raise your hand. The motion passes. The word paid will be added. Mark will be inserted. Mark your ballot. CD 20.3, add paid. And now we will proceed with 20.3 as amended. And it is on your screen with the word paid inserted. Is there any discussion on 20.3 as amended? All those in favor of CD 20.3 as amended, please raise your hand. All those opposed, the motion passes. Mark your ballot, CD 20.3 as amended.
Thank you, and I will continue with our report if I don't knock this off. At this point, I would just like to take a moment to thank the Federal Depository Library Program Task Force of the Committee on Legislation. You have heard over the months about their activity, and one of the vehicles for gathering information and input that we were using was an open dialogue session here at conference. And I am happy to say it was a huge success. We had over 70 people come to our open dialogue, and we had a really good, solid hour of getting input on the report as it stands. You also were made aware several times of the survey that is available for anyone to fill out and is still live and available through February 14th. So I thank all of you who have taken that survey and submitted it, and urge others to go ahead and do that by February 14th. I know that we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 to 170 responses already. So I would like to particularly thank the chair of that task force, Maggie Farrell, and also all of her hardworking task force members. This also comes to the point where I would like to mention that the Committee on Legislation on Friday of this meeting, at our first business meeting, did address the CD 49 document from Annual 13 that was referred to us. And we had a discussion about what to do with that at this point, and the committee passed a motion to say that we would defer further discussion of that document until we have the final report from the Federal Depository Library Program Task Force, as much of that resolution impacts or covers much of the same information. The only other thing that I would like to say is that this year will be the 40th anniversary of the National Library Legislation Day. We are always very thrilled to see our ALA member leaders there, and urge all of you who can possibly be there to attend. It is a group of some 400 representing all of our states. It's really quite a wonderful opportunity for our elected officials to take note of the dedication and the needs of library services. And I also always want to thank the Washington office staff for all of their hard work, and of course the hard work of all of the COL members. We have worked quite hard at this conference and hope that you are pleased with the work we are doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Vivian. And just as clarification, Legislative Day is May 5th and 6th in Washington. Microphone three.
Gina Persichini, Idaho Chapter Counselor. I had a question for the Committee on Legislation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. So while you're walking, I understand that it may be too soon, and there are reasons for it to be too soon. But I've seen and heard a number of questions about net neutrality, and I was wondering if you could just explain for us in this meeting why it's too soon. I know that I've heard it's too soon for us to say to have something on this, but I'm wondering if you could explain for the whole council so that then we can explain it to the members who have asked about it. Thank you.
It certainly was a topic that we had discussions about. We did not feel that we understood all of the implications of it at this point in order to start drafting a document or a resolution. It will clearly be on our agenda in June, and by that time we think that we will have had a chance to kind of analyze all that action impacts.
Microphone number three.
Bernie Margolis, Counselor at Large. Thank you, Vivian, for a wonderful report, and to the members of the committee and the Washington office staff. obviously there's an enormous amount of activity at our various governmental levels, and I think you've captured some of the most important elements in your report today. I am, however, a little, I guess, provoked, in maybe a positive way. The word Google, which is the name of a significant corporation, is mentioned, I think, four or five times in your report. And for me, it raises some concern about whether there is clarity in our practice when we accept money from corporations, particularly in the public policy arena. We have a fellowship that Google supports. We have webinars that Google's name is attached to. We have all kinds of different relationships with Google. And as I think many people here know, Google has its own secrecy policies. Google has not been as forthcoming about how it treats privacy issues as I think our values suggest it should be. Google, in fact, has removed some of the books that it has scanned from the Google Book Search Project and not given good reasons why they've done that. So there is some conflict in some of our values with what the corporation known as Google has practiced. So I'm wondering whether, and this really is more to Keith and maybe to Barbara, if you could help me and maybe my colleagues here understand what practice we use today to determine the kinds of relationships we have with a company like Google, whether there needs to be more clarity around those, whether we're getting enough in the way of financial resources from Google to attach their name as prominently as we have to some very important public-facing activities of the association. And while I'm singling out Google because I don't particularly like their practices and their what I see as their unresponsiveness, I've written them and emailed them many times, and I have never received a response from any of their leadership at all. In fact, from anyone in their corporation. So that's my sort of pet peeve with Google, but this really is something that is much more universal. How does that apply to how we relate to other corporations? And I don't, and that this is the provocation of your report, I don't see other companies infiltrating our public policy face as Google has. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bernie, just a point of clarification, you're referring to the attachment to the report, which is the Washington office action update?
Microphone number three.
I guess this is for the archivists among us on page 11 of CD 20-20.4. I think Google's mentioned two or three times. And then there's a few other pages where they're mentioned as well. So I'm not sure who is completely responsible. I thought this was COL's report. So
it is COL.
It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter whether it's COL. It's really this is a organization-wide, ALA-wide issue or question. And I'm sure Keith can probably give us some insights. Thank you.
All right. I thank you. I just wanted to have that clarification. I think Keith will speak to that.
Yeah, Keith, stay with me. Bernie and I had some beginning of a discussion at this during the break. Just at the top level, ALA has a policy on partnerships. And I don't remember the number, and I certainly don't remember the new number. But that basically talks about specific criteria that are applied when ALA is involved in partnerships. And with your permission, I will send a link to that as a follow-up to this meeting, because that has occasionally been a topic of much discussion. Beginning about 6 or 7 years ago, we had been evaluating partnerships on sort of an ad hoc basis, and that is a rather labor-intensive and a difficult process. Beginning probably 6 or 7 years ago, the board, and they have just done it at this meeting, approved a list of corporations with whom ALA will do business, if I can use that term. And what we have done is we use the TIA, CREF, and Domini Socially Responsibility Companies list, which is, I believe, about 2,000 corporations, and obviously includes the people that we're currently working with. So that whole issue of establishing broad parameters falls within that purview. There are, to now switch gears here, in each instance, we evaluate a partnership based on conformity with our mission and the advancement of our goals. We do have a number of other partnerships. What we're describing here is a corporation with whom we have certain areas of agreement and potentially certain areas of disagreement. Another example that comes readily to mind is, let's say, for instance, the American Association of Publishers, with whom we have joint projects for reading promotion, and at the same time we're at each other's throats in the courts, in some instances in legislative issues. The publishers themselves, for instance, we have adversarial relationships in certain areas and cooperative relationships in others. So I think that we have accepted as a principle that we can agree to disagree with partners in certain areas, assuming that they do not violate our core values, and at the same time can work very productively together to achieve our mission in other areas. So we work with publishers on reading promotion with whom we have severe disagreements with regard to things like licensing and pricing. So that's another example. The issue, however, of your particular concerns with Google, I would just respectfully suggest that a conversation with the Washington office would be helpful, because I think that we would be very interested in member concerns, and I bet we could get you an answer through our positive connections with Google. I do think that any questions about particular arrangements, I know that the Washington office would be happy to provide further information, so we can certainly provide a little bit more substance on that general question of how does this support our mission. Generally speaking, and let me say that this also, since I'm here and there's no timer going, this also applies to foundations and grants. And I think that ALA is looking a lot more closely at, we tend to be very excited at the possibility of getting a grant, especially if it's a large number, but we really need to always say, does this dilute from our focus on our core mission? Is this really taking us in directions that may weaken our focus in areas where we need to be intensely focused? And I think that we're trying to be more strategic in terms of, being approached or being involved with some of our old partners. We're trying to be more focused in all of those interactions, and that's something I think I can convey from the discussions we've had as part of our whole issue of rethinking the way that we're doing things.
I am aware that we need a break, so we'll do this last comment and then we'll have a break. Microphone 4.
Rob Banks, Executive Board. Vivian, thank you for your report, and I appreciate your answer on the net neutrality, but I'd like to take us back there for a little more clarification, if we could. I've had an awful lot of counselors and members visit with me about this because they're understandably quite concerned. I'd like to verify kind of my thinking on this, if it's accurate, that currently where it stands on the national level is that there are a number of directions this could go, depending on what actions FCC takes, courts take, et cetera, and that we are waiting to see which direction that goes so that we can craft our response according to the different directions. Is that correct understanding?
Yes, I think that is accurate. I think it's a complicated situation, and it's rather fresh and new, and we need to kind of let it fall out a little bit before we can make the most appropriate approach. And I think what we are thinking at this time is that we don't want to move too quickly so that we are perhaps going in the wrong direction or maybe not taking full awareness of all of the directions. I think that's a good way of putting it, that could happen. We know that this is, you know, I don't want to use the word shocked, but, you know, this was really a disappointing situation, and I think we're just trying to kind of step back and make sure that we fully understand all of the implications. And even though the timing was such that we might have addressed it here at this conference, and we did discuss it, we felt that in order to, you know, be prudent, we didn't want to bring a resolution forward at this time.
Thank you.
Councilors, microphone four.
Al Kagan, CERT Councilor. Just a point of information, is ALA Council already on record in favor of net neutrality or not?
Yes, I believe so. I'm sorry I can't cite the resolution or the background at the moment, but I am sure we have a position on that.
Thank you.
Hope I'm right.
Councilors, I hope you will forgive my I really do need to give a break to the captionist. All of you all can get up. She can't. So I would like, is this a very quick comment? Microphone three.
Sue Kam, Councillor at Large, point of personal privilege. I wanted to let councillors who might not be aware that Pete Seeger has died.
All right. I would like to call, thank you, Vivian. Sorry. Thank you very much. 10-minute break, please. Thank you. I now direct your attention to ALA CD number 36 and call upon Eric Cease, member of the ALA Awards Committee, to present the committee's report on behalf of Susan DiMattia, Chair, who was unable to attend today's meeting. Eric?
Thank you. We come to you with one item. Anytime a new ALA award is established, the process is to, after vetted by the awards committee, is to bring it to the executive board, and then from the executive board to bring it to you for your support. We have one such award that we chose to endorse to add to the stable of ALA awards, and this is a fun one. It is the Lemony Snicket Prize for Noble Librarians Faced with Adversity. And let me briefly read the definition of it. Lemony Snicket approached us and said he wanted to give this award. It is the opinion of Lemony Snicket, author, reader, and alleged malcontent, that librarians have suffered enough. Therefore, he's establishing an annual prize honoring a librarian who faced adversity with integrity and dignity intact. The prize will be a generous amount of cash for Mr. Snicket's disreputable gains, along with an odd symbolic object from his private stash and a certificate which may or may not be suitable for framing. It is Mr. Snicket's hope and the ALA's that the Snicket Prize will remind readers everywhere of the joyous importance of librarians and the trouble that is all too frequently unleashed upon them. We would give one ward a year. The committee would consist of a chair and four jury members, and at least one of that committee member would be from one of the children's divisions, one of the youth divisions, and at least one from either IFC or IFRT. There'd also be a staff liaison through the Office for Intellectual Freedom. Adversity is purposely left undefined, so I think there could be a really interesting mix of things, the adverse conditions that people have run into over the course of a year as we look at the jury looks at the prize. The award itself is $3,000 for the honoree, as well as up to $1,000 for travel, and up to $1,000 coverage, $1,000 toward administrative costs, for a total of $5,000. It will be reviewed after 3 years, and after 5 years, should the both sides wish to continue with this, it has been decided that the author will, in fact, Daniel Handler, known as Lemony Snicket, will, in fact, fund an endowment to keep this going, and that's very sharp. Essentially, that's it. It met with all the different guidelines that the awards committee is presented with, and we'd like to present this to you for your support.
Do you want to read what's on the screen, the motion?
Sure. We'd like to a motion to establish the Lemony Snicket Prize for Noble Librarians Faced with Adversity as outlined in CD number 36.
Is there any discussion of the motion? What? Microphone 4.
Mario Gonzalez, ALA Treasurer. I wanted to let the council know that this came to the executive board and we approved it.
Seeing no one at the microphone, I will ask you to vote on this motion to establish the Lemony Snicket Prize for Noble Librarians Faced with Adversity as outlined in CD number 36. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed, please raise your hand. The motion passes. Mark your ballot, CD number 36. And you may want to keep the description of this just for a light moment whenever you get...
And let me just say one more thing, if I can. Even though this is light, the fact that it's an adverse situation probably means that those who have gone through it is not necessarily a light situation, and we understand that. So that's where we are with that. The question, the burning question last night from Council Forum was, in fact, how do I get to be on the jury? And I, anyway, thank you very much.
Microphone 2.
Aaron Dobbs, Leda Councillor. Point of personal privilege, I'd just like to point out that ignoble librarians are also noble. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you. I would also like to call your attention just briefly to a couple of other report documents that were at the back room. What we decided is that we're not going to always have public presentation of reports from committees, but we've had so much discussion on reports from committees, and I'd like for you to be aware, to be reminded that we have an International Relations Committee report and a report to Council from the Committee on Professional Ethics. So you might read that because this is valuable work that members of our association are doing. Microphone 3.
Jennifer Bocha-Rusa, Councillor. Well, don't forget part of the role of the council is to advise and vote, but also to get information in that flow. So I would recommend that you still put on the agenda, not that they report, but they're available, and you call if there's any questions relating to those reports so that if there's an opportunity to clarify or to comment, that it gives us that opportunity.
Thank you. That's a wonderful suggestion. I now call, Microphone 4.
Zora Sampson, Counselor at Large, and connecting awards to things at the back of the room, if I may, I'd like to say I have put up the American Indian Library Association award-winning books, and I would like to encourage people to grab one. We did put out some snacks yesterday, and I hope you enjoyed them. And the important part is that these are Native authors and Native illustrators. So if you can get them in your library, great. Thank you for putting up with me.
Thank you. I now call upon Keith Michael Fields for his final announcements. Keith?
I'm waiting for the attendance figures to come up on the screen because that's how I'm going to find out what they are. Danielle? Okay, great. If I could have the attendance figures back, that'd be great. Okay. Drum roll. Oh, thank you. All right, we're going to our archival copy here. And the final attendance was 8,407 registrants and 3,800 exhibitors for a grand total of 12,207 attendees. My last announcement is that as we all climb back into our covered wagons and head back, please place your empty portfolios in the storage box at the papyrus pickup table, and we will retain it all for years at the 2014 annual conference. Thank you.
Please, microphone number 6.
One, in this case, Chair of BARC, I want to inform Council that BARC has received the resolution to allow programs at ALA midwinter meetings. However, this resolution came to us after we had finished our last meeting during this conference. So we will be addressing this and coming back to annual conference with a report.
Thank you. Please check to see that you have put your name at the top of the ballot and signed at the bottom, and pass your ballots to the aisle. Microphone number 3.
Hi, Charlotte Gerstein, Vermont Chapter Counselor. And I just wanted to put in a request that I like getting the reports from a person, like just a brief, like maybe it helps us focus on what's important. And then if we are all gathering here in person, there is value to kind of associating a person with a report and kind of knowing, you know, hearing about it from a human. So I'm going back to the fact that the reports were going to be just in paper and you were passing by having a person stand up and give a little summary.
I'm sorry. Are you talking about the professional ethics and international relations?
Yes, the fact that having us just get the paper one, and as if that's more efficient, and maybe it is more efficient, but there is a value to gathering together in person, and one of those items is that we associate a person with a committee, and so hearing from the person personally is what I'm asking for.
All right. Part of it is maybe when we make them available, because we can't really ask them to stay an extra day in order to do that.
Okay. But I understand.
Maybe
now
the reports would be available earlier, and then the person could be here.
Okay, yes, good.
Thank you. Microphone 4.
Mario Gonzalez, ALA Treasurer. This afternoon at the executive board meeting, I and Pat Wand will give our reports, Pat as Chair of BARC and I as Treasurer, for all the meetings that took place at this conference. This report is available on the Treasurer's website. However, I feel that it's very important that you get this information, so we will be sending this out to you rather than having you look it up on the Treasurer's link. Thank you.
I would like to ask all executive board members and newly elected board members to meet here in front of the podium so we can determine what time we're going to meet this afternoon. Councillors, we've concluded our agenda. If there is no objection, I declare the third meeting of the ALA Council adjourned. Have a safe trip.